For NHL fans, players, and general managers alike, the National Hockey League's mad dash toward the trade deadline offers a unique combination of excitement and anxiety with just a sprinkle of healthy skepticism. However you break it down, it's the most hectic day of the National Hockey League's regular season and an event we all anticipate for one reason and one reason only. Trades. Glorious trades. Whether they are consummated on deadline day, draft day, or even a player's birthday, they are the breaking news stories that grab our collective attention. In the latest episode of NHL Backstory, we'll take a deep dive into NHL trades, evaluating all the angles of a unique world in which the only constant is change.
After trade deadline 3 o'clock, at 1 o'clock, there's a lot of chatter. People are throwing out a lot of opinions. By 2:30, it gets pretty quiet.
Sure enough, I see my name on the ticker. I was in Montreal getting ready to go play a game, and away I left the hotel room and had my bag and flew into Florida.
I've heard of guys being on the team plane getting traded and notified, and they land and have to go to their new team. It's a crazy life. It's a crazy world.
I'm Arto Ocal, and welcome to another episode of NHL Backstory. This is episode 2, Tales from the Deadline.
My name is Bill Guerin. I am president of hockey operations and general manager for the Minnesota Wild.
Bill Guerin, a national treasure, 3-time Olympian, silver medalist in 02, and oh, by the way, some Stanley Cup rings as well.
The recent trade deadline was a busy time for Guerin and his fellow NHL executives, but the Minnesota Wild GM may be uniquely qualified to talk about life at the deadline. That's because, as a player, Guerin was traded at the deadline twice in 3 seasons. The final time he was moved at the deadline, he went from a struggling New York Islanders team to a Pittsburgh Penguins club with its sights set on a deep Stanley Cup run.
Yeah, they had a couple other guys on the team that could carry the load. I forget their names. Oh, guys like Crosby, Malkin, Letang, Gonchar was there. Guys like myself, Chris Kunitz, Craig Adams came in, and yeah, we could all just assume a role. We didn't upset the apple cart. You know, nobody was really getting, you know, bounced around. It turned out to be a real blessing to go to Pittsburgh. And we won the Stanley Cup that year, and it was unbelievable.
To the point, Rafalski shoots, knocked down in the mad scramble. Lidstrom shoots it, a tremendous save by Fleury. They've done it. The Penguins have done it. Sidney Crosby and the Penguins have won the Stanley Cup.
Guerin isn't the only active general manager who was moved at the deadline during his playing career. He's actually one of 8 current GMs who experienced some good old deadline madness. That list includes Ron Francis of the Seattle Kraken, Craig Conroy of the Calgary Flames, and Mike Greer of the San Jose Sharks.
I've got 2 experiences of being traded at the deadline that I feel helped me, but hey, look, Steve Yzerman never got traded at the deadline. He's doing pretty good. But maybe he's had teammates that have come in and he's seen it from that perspective. So I think just having played and been around, whatever way you've experienced a deadline can help you.
Edmonton Oilers general manager Ken Holland doesn't have firsthand experience with the trade deadline as a player. As a goalie, he only appeared in 4 National Hockey League games. But since becoming Detroit Red Wings general manager in 1997, a post he held for 22 years, he's been one of the league's most prolific and most successful executives. Here's how he describes his war room at the deadline.
Lots of phone calls, staying in touch with, not all 31, because I think if you as you work your way towards the trade deadline, I think you have to decide one of 3 things. Is your team going to be in buying mode, looking to acquire players? Is your team having a tough season and you're looking to trade players away and you become a seller? Or are you sort of on the bubble and you don't really want to give up on the season, but you're not sure how good your team is? So I call it stand pat.
So how hectic can the trade deadline get? Well, it varies from year to year, but here are some of the figures we came across courtesy of NHL Stats and Info. Between 1980, when the league began tracking information specific to trade deadline day, and 2024, 1,293 players were dealt on deadline day in 718 separate trades. That includes 14 players who were traded twice on the same deadline day. The most active deadline team is the Pittsburgh Penguins, who've acquired 72 players during that span. And perhaps most important, since 1980, 28 players traded at the deadline have gone on to win the Stanley Cup that season. That includes this guy.
There's a goal! Arturi Lekkonen has scored! And for the second straight year, he sent his team in overtime to the Stanley Cup Final!
In 2022, the Colorado Avalanche acquired Arturi Lekkonen at the trade deadline before going on their magical championship run. And Lekkonen proved to be a crucial piece in Colorado's quest for the Cup. He didn't just score the overtime goal in Game 4 against Edmonton to send the Avs to the Cup Final.
Now they get tangled up again behind the play. 3-on-2 for the Avalanche. Manson McKinnon back for Manson. Tapped over. Score! It's Arturi Lekkonen! It's a work of art!
He also scored the cup-winning goal in Game 6 against the Tampa Bay Lightning, becoming the only player since 1980 to be acquired on deadline day and score the cup winner that same year. Lekkonen's post-deadline heroics made him the latest in a long line of important role players who joined their teams just in time to start a historic championship run. When thinking about trades at the deadline, the first name that comes to mind is usually Butch Goring, who in 1980, after 11 seasons with the Los Angeles Kings, was traded at the deadline to the New York Islanders and helped kickstart a historic run of four straight titles. More recently, the Tampa Bay Lightning improved their roster when they acquired Barclay Goodrow on deadline day in 2020, just a week after trading for fellow forward Blake Coleman. When asked about these transactions on deadline day that season, Lightning general manager Julien Brisebois clearly outlined the rationale behind acquiring these two players.
When we met at our mid-year meetings, met with the coaching staff and met with our pro scouting staff, we had identified that we could really benefit from adding two forwards to our group. Two forwards that would be able to play a heavy, hard, competitive game. Ideally, they'd be signed to contracts that provide really good value from a cap standpoint.
Turns out Brisebois knew exactly what he was talking about. The Lightning really did strike twice at the 2020 trade deadline, as Goodrow and Coleman solidified a third forward line that put the Lightning over the top, filling out a roster that would win back-to-back Stanley Cups in 2020 and 2021.
Goodrow carries across the blue line, open right circle.
No.
Pass in front, score!
What a job!
What a goal by Blake Coleman! 3/10 of a second on the clock, and it's 2-1 Lightning!
It's a pretty inexact science, but acquiring the right role players at the trade deadline can sometimes mean the difference between a competitive team and a dynasty. And there was one NHL executive who truly helped establish that model for the deadline.
I'm Neil Smith, and I was general manager and president of the New York Rangers from 1989 to 2000. I think that in the 90s, the trade deadline was like the night before Christmas for husbands, for shopping for gifts for their wife. You know, you waited and waited and waited and made sure that you were getting the best deal you could, and then you bought it on Christmas Eve. The same thing with the trading deadline, the GMs would that were having players that they wanted to trade to move along, they would wait to see if they could get a better deal for them.
With the Rangers, Smith put together a truly impressive roster that had championship aspirations. But it was his work on the big day in 1994 that forever changed how people viewed the NHL trade deadline. The moves actually started the previous year when Smith and the Rangers traded young prospect Doug Weight to the Edmonton Oilers for veteran forward Esa Tikkanen. The two players didn't have to go far to join their new teams that day, as the Oilers were already in New York to play the Rangers.
In case you've just joined us, do not adjust your television set. Esa Tikkanen is playing for the New York Rangers tonight. Doug Weight is a member of the Edmonton Oilers.
Tikkanen joined a Rangers roster that included former Oilers teammates Mark Messier, Kevin Lowe, Adam Graves, and Jeff Beukeboom. but Neil Smith had a plan to fill out his roster even more at the 1994 trade deadline. And that plan included contacting then Edmonton Oilers GM Glenn Sather about acquiring more Oilers players.
So I had been talking to Glenn Sather about Craig McTavish for the whole second half of the season, because he was a great shutdown third line center for Edmonton over the years, and I would like to get him to New York, and I felt that Glenn would trade him because it was the last year of his contract.
At the urging of Rangers head coach Mike Keenan, Smith also reached out to Bob Pulford, general manager of the Chicago Blackhawks, and offered up a young right winger named Tony Amonte.
Mike Keenan had been bugging me all year to get Stephen Matteau from Chicago. He didn't particularly think that Amonte was the kind of player we needed. And I, being a former scout and GM, didn't want to dispense with a young player, so I wouldn't trade him straight for Matteau because I knew he'd be a star. And so by the deadline, I finally talked Bob Pulford into giving me Brian Noonan along with Stephen Matteau, and we made that deal.
The final haul for Smith and the Rangers during that 1994 deadline ended up including McTavish and Glenn Anderson, who had also won multiple championships in Edmonton, along with Noonan and Matteau. The four players acquired on deadline day remains a record for a team that went on to win the Stanley Cup, and no single acquisition proved more important than Matteau.
Stefan is a kid I've known since he was 18 years old. I took him to a Bon Jovi concert. We always talk about this when he was 18 at Joe Louis Arena, when I was chief scout in Detroit. But when Steph got to our team, I mean, he fit right in. He scored in Calgary right away the night that we got him. He was a good big body, checking forward. In the playoffs, he had the ability to step up his game, and he scored two really big overtime goals for us in Game 3 of the Devils series and then in Game 7.
Matteau swoops in to intercept. Matteau behind the net. Swings it in front. He scores! Matteau! Stephen Matteau! And the Rangers have one more hill to climb, baby!
He was terrific in the fact that without him, we don't win the cup.
More NHL backstory after this.
Get the official NHL app to watch, read, and listen to all the deets.
All I can say is absolutely wow.
All the sauce, all the saves.
Stop from Vasilevsky!
All the hits, all the snipes, all the sellies.
He scores! Unbelievable!
All the hockey. If it's hockey, it's here. Listen to every NHL game for free now with Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. Download the official NHL app now.
Over the years, deadline acquisitions like Ron Francis, Rob Blake, Jeff Carter, and Kimmo Timonen have helped propel their new teams to a championship. But big trades don't have to be confined to the deadline. In fact, NHL history has been largely shaped by all kinds of player transactions. Think about Patrick Waugh going to Colorado, Chris Pronger to the Ducks, and Brendan Shanahan to the Red Wings. Blockbuster deals that completely shifted the NHL's competitive balance. But when it comes to the week leading up to the deadline, there's one transaction that would later give hockey fans around the world one of the most indelible images in NHL history.
There's one player who's waited a long time to hoist this.
1 year after acquiring Ray Bourque, in the days leading up to the 2000 trade deadline, the Colorado Avalanche gave the legendary defenseman the one accolade missing from his resume after 21 remarkable seasons with the Boston Bruins.
Joe Sakic immediately turns and hands it to Ray Bourque, who lifts it up and over his head. Ray Bourque, 22 years, had waited for this moment.
So how beloved was the future Hall of Famer among Bruins fans? After winning the Cup with Colorado, he got his very own parade in Boston.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome home number 77, Raymond Bourque.
I am here today to say thank you to all of you. This is home for me and my family. We've had some great years here with the Bruins, and the support that you show today certainly shows me that you guys all understood what it was all about and what I had to do.
Here's how Bourque remembered that historic trade when he was interviewed during the NHL's centennial celebration in 2017.
At the time, I was 38 years old. The situation in Boston wasn't a healthy one, so I wanted to stay east. I thought Philly was a done deal. I heard St. Louis was closed, New Jersey, Detroit, Colorado, and Philly. I ended up going to Colorado, and it was a perfect fit. It was a little further than I thought I was going to go. And I know instantly when I got there, the team was phenomenal, incredibly talented, and my game kind of just took off. I kind of knew that this would be fun and that I had more than just that year left. So we ended up going to the semifinals that year, losing to Dallas in the seventh game, and I knew that I was coming back for another year. So that next year was just a real special one.
Countless players have learned they were moved under less than ideal circumstances. Take Jared Smithson, who was traded from Florida to Edmonton in 2013, on the day his wife was reportedly scheduled to give birth to their child.
All right, let's go near the Avalanche locker room. As you can see, there's Mark Miller, equipment trainer for the Avalanche, Matt Duchene in street clothes. That's the hallway right outside the locker room.
In a 2017 road game against the New York Islanders, Colorado forward Matt Duchene suited up, took warm-ups, saw just under 2 minutes of ice time, then immediately left the building when he found out he'd been traded mid-game. TV cameras even caught him on his way out.
And if you're looking for somebody that can score a tying goal, you'd think a guy like Mike Camilleri, Jack, but we haven't seen him for some time in this hockey game, not on the Canadian bench.
Well, if that's an additional injury, that is a crippling blow for the Canadiens. Here's Krejci.
The bizarre Duchene move mirrored a previous incident involving Mike Camilleri, who in 2012 learned he was shipped from the Montreal Canadiens to the Calgary Flames in the middle of a game.
We're hearing from the truck driver reports that he has been traded during the game? That's a new one.
In 1980, General Manager Lou Nanny of the Minnesota North Stars acquired forward Frank Beaton from the New York Islanders and their legendary GM, Bill Torrey. Minnesota's return in the trade? A steak dinner. Here's how Nanny remembers the NHL reacting to that particular deal.
So I sent the trade papers into Brian O'Neill. He was a senior vice president of the league in charge of this stuff, and he calls me back. He says, you guys can't do this, Lou. You're making fun of the league. You're making a mockery of the league. I said, what are you talking about? He said, we can't trade for dinners. I said, well, you got, you know, $100 or future considerations. He said, well, make future considerations and work it out. So we put down future considerations, and then later that year when we were playing in, against the Islanders, he and I went to dinner at La Palme. I picked up the bill, and it was $157, and I sent it to Brian O'Neill. I said, see, I told you this is worth more than $100 waivers or future considerations. So we were able to do the deal for dinner at La Palme.
Of course, a steak dinner was expensive compared to the deal former Winnipeg Jets GM Mike Smith made with then Tampa Bay Lightning GM Phil Esposito.
Tampa had already taken a player from us. We had some extra players with a lot of depth, and I offered him Danton Cole for a dollar, and he said, I'll take Danton Cole. And Phil gave me a dollar on the spot.
Following a similar trade between Anaheim and Nashville, then Ducks assistant GM David McNabb actually sent Predators management a check for $1. David Poile, Nashville's general manager at the time, was so taken aback that he had it framed. The Buffalo Sabres traded forward Ray Sheppard to the New York Rangers for $1 in 1990. 3 years later, he eclipsed the 50-goal mark with the Red Wings. Here's Neil Smith, who orchestrated the Ray Sheppard trade for the Rangers.
You had to give some consideration. So you just said, well, you know, I'll do it for a dollar. You know, it sort of made light of it between the GMs.
On paper, these players were exchanged for the always popular future considerations. But in actual negotiations, players were really exchanged for what Canadians referred to as a loony. Chris Draper is the reigning king of the Dollar Trade Club.
We had a problem with Chris Draper. The minor league coach didn't like him. The major league coach wouldn't play him.
Once again, that's former Winnipeg Jets GM Mike Smith.
And by this time, Chris who's a bouncy, smiley, happy person, was, I wouldn't say depressed, but he looked at his feet all the time. He didn't smile. I mean, he was confused. So I couldn't fire the coaches just for Chris, and or I guess maybe hindsight, I should have. So I talked to Chris's agent, Don Meehan, and said, you know, we got to find another team for Chris to play on. He's not going to make it in this organization, and he's going to be an NHL player. We just got to give him a new life somewhere. Brian Murray was the general manager. I think Doug McClain was the assistant general manager. But they didn't want to give anything up for him. And I didn't really want anything for him. I just wanted to find a new place for him, give him a chance to play.
So Smith said, just send us a dollar and we'll send you Chris.
Who knows, probably the best dollar that the Detroit Red Wings ever spent.
That's former Red Wings general manager and current Edmonton GM Ken Holland. He was Detroit's head of amateur scouting at the time.
I think there's only seven players in Red Wing history to play 1,000 games in a Red Wing uniform, and Chris Draper is one of them.
Shanahan blocked it. Martin LaPointe, center jump, score! Chris Draper!
Draper went on to become a Red Wings legend, hoisting the Stanley Cup four times. He now serves as the team's assistant general manager and director of amateur scouting. But no conversation about the NHL's colorful trade history would be complete without talking to this guy.
Good afternoon. Peter Pocklington bought the Edmonton Oilers in 1976, WHA. And obviously we worked hard to join the NHL in 79. Very exciting and loved every minute of it.
There was plenty to love about the Oilers' first decade in the National Hockey League. By the mid-1980s, the once promising club had morphed into a full-fledged dynasty and one of the most dominant teams in NHL history.
Ladies and gentlemen, from coast to coast, the 1988 Stanley Cup champions, the Edmonton Oilers, have won it again.
And it's with mixed emotions, but I guess with delight and sincere best wishes for Wayne Gretzky.
Pocklington was at the helm when Edmonton, fresh off its fourth championship in five seasons, traded Wayne Gretzky to the Los Angeles Kings on August 9th, 1988. It remains to this day one of the biggest trades in sports history and a move that changed hockey forever.
Well, there were reasons why it happened. His contract was coming near the end. We had a year to go. And under the rules in those days, he would have become a free agent. Because we were a Canadian hockey team, Canadian dollars, and paying everybody in U.S. dollars, obviously, we didn't have in those days $10 or so million to match anybody else's bid. So I was forced to talk to two people about a trade, and completed one with Bruce McNall, who paid $15 million U.S. at that time, about $19 million Canadian.
They called it the trade of the century, August 9, 1988. The holder of 49 NHL records, number 99, Wayne Gretzky.
Obviously, it was no fun in Edmonton. I had to send my wife and family out of town for a week. I ended up with a lot of death threats and ended up carrying something I didn't like to carry. But anyway, that was life in them days.
The trade was considered a national tragedy in Canada, but the Oilers actually won another Stanley Cup 2 years later. And getting Gretzky was a boon for the Kings, who enjoyed unprecedented success and ushered in a new era in which the NHL expanded to numerous warm weather cities.
I knew that going in, it would do great things for LA. Their total gate at that time was $4 million. That would hardly pay a goalie these days. And when Wayne was delivered to Los Angeles the following year, their gate was $22 million. So it was a great deal for Los Angeles to put them on the map. And it was a good deal for Edmonton. It was a good deal for really everybody, although emotionally it was tough.
Pocklington was long known as the man who traded Wayne Gretzky. But to be fair, Gretzky was traded again in 1996, just a few weeks before the trade deadline, in a deal that saw the great one join Brett Hull and Chris Pronger with the St. Louis Blues.
They're on their feet, number 99 in the Blues home white sweater on the ice. And what a scene this is, a standing ovation for the great one here in St. Louis.
When the Rangers won the Stanley Cup in 1994, the team featured seven players who had previously been part of the Edmonton Oilers dynasty in the 1980s. But the 1996 St. Louis Blues truly brought the band back together, adding Gretzky to a club featuring former Oilers teammates Anderson, Jeff Courtnell, Charlie Huddy, and Grant Fuhr. Matteau, Noonan, and Jay Wells, who had all been part of the 1994 Rangers team, were also there, as was Mike Keenan, the man behind the bench for that legendary blue shirt squad. It seemed like a perfect roster, right up until the Blues were eliminated in Game 7 of the second round on a legendary double overtime winner from Steve Yzerman.
Gretzky had it, lost it, Yzerman picks it up. Yzerman moving, blue line chance, score!
Like I said, the deadline isn't an exact science. The backstory continues after this.
Today, when it comes to following sports, a basic box score just won't cut it. Get the stats behind the stats with NHL Edge. So you won't just see Makar's time on ice. You'll see where he spent it. You won't just know Matthews scored. You'll know how hard he shot it. And you won't just get OV's shot total. You'll know where he shot it from. Even if they're all from the same place. Know more about every stat, every shift, and every star with NHL Edge.
In the long history of NHL trades, there may be one in particular that takes the crown. A move so huge, so unusual, that it still seems unbelievable.
The Quebec Nordiques are very proud to select as first pick overall in the 1991 NHL annual draft, the General d'Oshawa, the Légion de l'Ontario, from the Oshawa Generals of the OHL, Eric Lindros.
Here's the backstory. In 1991, the Quebec Nordiques selected forward Eric Lindros with the first overall pick in the draft. Considered a generational talent, Lindros refused to sign with the team and wouldn't even put on their jersey during the broadcast. By the time the draft came around the following year, GMs were clamoring around Quebec owner Marcel Aubut to see if they could acquire Lindros. Naturally, Rangers GM Neil Smith was at the front of the line.
They had a fortress set up at the top of a hotel. They had basically half the floor for just the Nordiques people. And you would go up there and talk to Pierre Paget, the GM, negotiating what players you might give them for the rights to Lindros. And of course, they didn't tell you what was going on with any of the other teams. You know, you were up all night trying to get this thing done the night before the draft. I literally never went to bed. So I was in a bad mood when I got to the arena, and I still didn't know whether the deal was consummated.
From the home of hockey, the Montreal Forum, it's the 1992 NHL Entry Draft.
But Smith soon realized that the Flyers were interested in Lindros too.
So as I'm on the floor of the draft in the Montreal Forum, Jay Snyder comes by and says, Neil, don't announce your trade. And I said, what trade? He says, the trade for Lindros. I said, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm not announcing any trades because I wasn't going to tip my hand to them, you know, what I was doing, because I didn't know what they were doing.
Well, I'm Jay Snyder. I ran the Flyers for about 11 years as team president from the early to mid-80s to early to mid-90s.
What took place that day on the floor of the 1992 draft proved to be one of the most bizarre sequences in sports history.
There were phone calls, and I don't remember all of the details of all the various calls, but Russ Farwell, our GM at the time, and I went to Quebec and met with them, and we spent I don't know how many hours, and there were names going up on whiteboards. They got a lot in the end from us, but the ask was even bigger to start with. I mean, it must have been 12 names on there, and I don't know if they wanted them all, but they kind of wanted everything. And we went back and forth, and this just became an ongoing dialogue leading right up to the draft that year in Montreal.
Just like Neil Smith, Jay Snyder came to the 1992 draft in Montreal looking to close a deal with Quebec for Eric Lindros. And also just like Neil Smith, he thought he had done that.
The agreement was completed the morning of the draft. I mean, we felt the night before that we were there, but he was very cagey about it. He was not committed to us yet. It was not tipping his hand. And that didn't happen until just before the draft, maybe an hour before or less.
That day's NHL draft established a new record for Europeans selected in the first round. But very few people at the event were paying much attention to the prospects enjoying their big moment. All day long, the media at the event were fixated on the ensuing Eric Lindros saga.
I cannot tell you the feeling of anticipation and drama that has been building in this building all morning long. In fact, in Montreal all week long. The central name, of course, has been Eric Lindros.
Snyder was convinced the deal had been consummated when Obu allowed him and the Flyers to call Lindros personally and confirm he would be willing to come to Philadelphia.
We called immediately and we ascertained that he was willing to play.
But the drama was just getting started.
We learned a half an hour ago that Lindros was going to be traded from Quebec to the Chicago Blackhawks. At the last minute, both Chicago and New York withdrew their offers because the Philadelphia Flyers have stepped in, and we have been told that that is now a done deal. Eric Lindros will become a member of the Philadelphia Flyers.
The details weren't public yet, but it appeared that after a year of waiting for Eric Lindros to find a team he would be willing to join and finally begin his NHL career, the future star had been traded. Twice. Reporters at the draft didn't get much information from Nordiques general manager Pierre Paget or then Blackhawks coach Mike Keenan, who was also rumored to be working on a Lindros trade.
Are we going to hear about Eric Lindros today?
Probably.
Thank you. We hear Philly. Is it true?
I can't say.
Thanks, Pierre.
Sorry.
Mike Keenan, are you still in the Eric Lindros sweepstakes?
We have no comment regarding that situation at this time.
Again, Flyers team president Jay Snyder.
At this point, our whole scouting staff and so forth had already gone over to the forum and were set up for the draft, and it was just Russ Farwell and I still in the room, in our suite, and there's a knock on the door. I open it, there's Marcel Obu, and he said, I've traded him to the Rangers.
The entire first day of the draft came and went without any formal announcement about an Eric Lindros trade, which made it abundantly clear that there was a problem. That's when NHL General Counsel and Vice President Gil Stein brought in Toronto lawyer Larry Bertuzzi to proceed over an arbitration hearing, which took place in Montreal over 4 days with the Nordiques, Flyers and Rangers, each presenting their own case.
We started the next morning with a preliminary meeting among all the parties. I tried like hell on Sunday, and I think it was even Monday. I was trying to get a law firm in Montreal to represent us, and no one would take the case on our end. Meanwhile, our attorney, Phil Weinberg, his wife was in labor and delivering their first baby. And I'm calling him in the delivery room. Phil, you got to come up here. And he's whispering, no, the baby's about to come out. So he left, amazingly, like maybe the day after the baby was born. So once we really got into the arbitration, which began immediately, Phil showed up and took over on our end.
With the entire Lindros saga coming to a boil, things got pretty intense.
Just a lot of tension, and there were a few times that angry words were exchanged across the table, and I don't think Bertuzzi had a gavel, but if he did, he would have been banging it to stop us. It wasn't horrible, but it wasn't good. When we walked into the room, there were no niceties every day.
Before sharing his decision with the world, Bertuzzi called Jay Snyder and the Flyers with the news.
We sat around a speakerphone, and of course we were on edge. And then he got to the point, and I said something like, and again, worth looking up, but I find that Quebec made an enforceable deal with Philadelphia.
For Bertuzzi, the fact that Obu had allowed Snyder and the Flyers to call Lindros about playing for Philadelphia confirmed that they had consummated a trade agreement.
we erupted. Like, we had it on mute, and then we just erupted in high fives and cheers and stuff. Well, what I didn't know is that, like, the whole staff of the Flyers had gathered outside my office. It wasn't a big area. They were crowded in like sardines, probably. And when they heard us, they erupted in cheers. All of a sudden, we heard them. So it was a really exciting moment.
Bertuzzi revealed his decision live on Canadian television with the kind of pomp and circumstance that even the prime minister wasn't used to getting.
Obu wanted as many clubs as possible in the bidding right up to the end. He maintains that his communications with Snyder and his permitting Snyder to contact the Lindros family were merely attempts to qualify Philadelphia as a bidder at the end of the process. In his efforts, I find he clearly concluded an enforceable deal with Philadelphia with respect to Lindros and other consideration.
Neil Smith and the Rangers had a different reaction to Bertuzzi's announcement.
To be honest with you, I was stunned that we didn't get him. But of course, looking back, I didn't know what was going on with other teams. So I had no idea what Quebec was doing because this had never happened in the history of the league.
Bertuzzi's announcement didn't just alter the competitive balance of the NHL. It forever changed how the National Hockey League handled trades. When Gary Bettman came in the following year as NHL commissioner, he formalized the process by which trade calls were conducted with the league, ensuring that nothing like the Lindros fiasco could ever happen again. In a way, it marked the end of an era during which NHL trades could take place with little oversight. NHL Backstory, we'll be right back.
NHLShop.com, the official online store of the National Hockey League, and the world's largest selection of officially licensed NHL fan gear, with unique one-of-a-kind designs by Fanatics, Adidas, and all the latest styles for every NHL team. Don't miss out. Shop now and get today's special offer. NHLShop.com, a Fanatics experience.
When it came to finding a true authority on the unique world of NHL trades, we wanted to give the floor to someone who has never played an NHL game or was an executive in the league.
Hi, hello. My name's Carla. I'm Mike's wife, and I'm the mom to Owen, Lucas, and Cole Sillinger.
This is Carla Sillinger, one of the NHL's many hockey moms. Carla's husband is longtime NHL player Mike Sillinger. Not only did Carla raise three sons, including a current NHL player, but she did so while being married to the most traded player in NHL history.
Played 4 years junior hockey, and then when I had a chance to play in the Red Wings at 20 years old, I got sent right to the minors. So they sent me down to Adirondack. I was kind of like a bit shocked, going like, what's going on here? Like, I'm a first rounder. Like, why am I not getting a chance to play in this team? So I played there, won the Calder Cup, made the NHL the next year. It was kind of, you know, in and out of the lineup, up and down, the whole deal. And, you know, 2 or 3 years went by, and my advisor and myself, we kind of discussed that maybe it'd be better if I moved on. And we kind of asked for the trade, and ever since then, the trades kept going. So.
Over his 16 NHL seasons, Mike Sillinger was traded a record 10 times. That run includes getting traded on deadline day in consecutive seasons. By the time Mike was embarking on the most nomadic career in NHL history, the job of constantly adjusting their home life often fell on Carla. That job got considerably more complicated once they had a family. When Mike went to his new team, Carla and countless NHL spouses just like her were left to move their belongings, find a new place to live, put the kids in new schools, and basically uproot an entire family to start from scratch.
Well, the first few times I was a rookie, kind of, if you want to say that, at it, and I just made the phone calls that had to be made and went there and tried to make things as comfortable, you know, for Mike as possible, buying the house or renting the house where the, you know, traffic was or close to the rink or whatever. And after a while I was like, geez, this is kind of getting a little bit easier, I guess, after a few times that it happened. But mostly, I mean, there's definitely pros and cons. you know, would we want it to stay with an organization for the whole time? Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, you build roots and you make friends, and it's really hard actually to leave places. But on the flip side of that, you know, I'm a girl from Saskatchewan. I would have never gotten to see the places that I saw or meet the people that I've got to meet along the way.
I think the biggest thing was that, you know, that's where I totally understood it was a business. You know, everywhere I went, I had 25 guys welcome me, you know, welcome to the team, and here I have to leave my wife and family behind. So as we started to have the kids and everything, obviously it got a lot tougher for her and everything, is, you know, I had to change schools and change everything.
Sometimes I was pregnant, sometimes I just had a baby, or put the Christmas tree up one day and took the Christmas tree down the next day. But now that I look back at it, those are all the good memories, you know, and houses are really just houses. You know, stuff is just stuff. That's, I didn't really look at it as far as that goes. I just was happy that we were all together. Of course, the trade deadline, the Easter Bunny just goes to a different place. There was Mike and I, but then there was my three little best friends. And we just said, let's go. Guess where we're going now, right? And then as they got to play hockey themselves, you know, it got maybe a little bit tougher, but it was an adventure all the time.
Mike and Carla's son, Cole, is a forward with the Columbus Blue Jackets and is the first person to attest to his mom's role in their family.
She's the glue of the family. I think I take a lot of qualities and look up to her just as much as I do my dad. Every time the trade deadline came around, it obviously made my mom pretty nervous, but she was the one that, you know, was driving us and my older brothers to hockey games and stuff like that when my dad was on the road.
Even if he wasn't old enough during his father's playing career to remember the constant moving, Cole Sillinger has heard the stories. And there's one in particular he enjoys telling.
The greatest story was right around the deadline. He either went from Tampa to Florida or from Florida to Tampa, one or the other. And we had a bunch of family come down. It was right at the deadline. And my mom was like super nervous because, you know, there was talk that he was going to get traded, and we had probably 20 people down, and he ended up getting traded, but he got traded just to the, you know, either Tampa or Florida, whatever one it was. So everyone was like kind of relieved they didn't have to move too much, just a couple hour drive. So I thought that was pretty funny.
Like his friend and former teammate Mike Sillinger, Minnesota Wild general manager Bill Guerin says none of this would have been possible without his wife.
They handle it, you know, and we're lucky. We're lucky to have a partner like that, because it is not easy. Hey, look, we pick up. We're on the next flight. We're out that day. Like, we're gone. And, you know, we go and live in a hotel. And we're with the guys, and we're playing our games. We're having a great time. We had 20 new buddies, and they're back home. You know, my wife was dealing with four little kids and doing all the driving by herself and cooking the meals. And it's hard, you know. And, yeah, you need that solid family home foundation.
The first trade was definitely probably the hardest. You're thinking, you know, this is a team that doesn't want you anymore. Comparison where you're going to a team that wants you and needs you. And you tend to think the worst part of it, thinking that this team, you know, it's a team that didn't want you. But after that, you realize that it's a business and you just kind of roll with it.
That's Brent Ashton. He was the NHL's reigning trade king when he retired in 1993, before Mike Sillinger came into the picture. Like Sillinger, Ashton was born and raised in Saskatchewan. He even served as a stick boy for his hometown Saskatoon Blades before playing four seasons with the junior team. There was no indication early in his career that Ashton would become the league's all-time house hunter. He was drafted by the Vancouver Canucks and spent his first two seasons with the club. And he was on the golf course in his native Saskatoon during the summer of 1981 when his brother Ron sprinted towards him to let him know the team was trying to get in touch. It was then that Ashton learned he'd been shipped to the Colorado Rockies as part of a three-team trade.
Rockies' biggest problem is figuring out who is who. Of the 19 players that ended the season last year in a Rockies uniform, 11 faces are different tonight.
Just 1 year later, Ashton was on the move again as the largely no-name Rockies moved to New Jersey to become the Devils.
It wasn't really a trade. It was just the whole team got moved. That situation was different. But, like I say, when we moved from Colorado to New Jersey, too, became the Devils at that time, the first time, you know, that was a difficult move because nobody knew where to go, where to live. didn't have much support going there. It was a new team. So in that situation, it was probably a little more difficult.
Early on in his career, Ashton was traded 3 times in 29 months, and that didn't include the Rockies' relocation to New Jersey. When he landed in Detroit during the 1986-87 season, Ashton thought he might finally get to establish some roots in an original six city. The coaching staff had expressed their trust in him, and he was joining a nucleus of rising talent led by the Red Wings' young captain, Steve Yzerman. He was traded 17 months later. Even worse, he built a house in Detroit for his young family.
You build a house and then you're living it for a year and then you get traded. Well, it's not a great situation when you're trying to sell a house and people know that you're not coming back to that city. They know that there's probably a deal to be had, put it that way. I think that's why I tended to rent a lot after that.
Brent Ashton says he wouldn't have minded spending much of his NHL career with a single team, but the 3 decades that have passed since injuries forced him to call it a career have made him philosophical about his pro hockey experience. And for the longtime journeyman, it was all just part of the wild ride.
To be able to experience that, live in Boston, lived in Detroit, got to live in, you know, Colorado, Quebec City, had some good playoff runs. You weren't just kind of stuck on a team that wasn't making playoffs. I went to the semifinals 3 or 4 times, so sometimes you get on one team, you don't get that opportunity, whereas when you get moved around a bit, teams are trying to add players to make a run, then you get a chance to go a little further in playoffs, and it was still a good experience. I mean, the game of hockey, I still enjoyed it, and to move around like that and play in different cities and get to experience that, I think, I don't know if I'd have wanted any other way.
If the nonstop movement leading up to the NHL trade deadline teaches us anything, it's that nothing is forever in the National Hockey League. More recently, restrictions imposed by the salary cap and no trade clauses have made trades much more difficult to navigate, ensuring that we may have seen the last of the likes of Brent Ashton and Mike Sillinger. In 2015, for example, Anaheim Ducks defenseman Eric Brewer famously had to waive his no-trade clause by scribbling a formal message on a napkin. And even then, the Ducks barely got Brewer's confirmation to the NHL before the deadline passed.
I played with Brewer a couple times. I know him well. It was definitely a bar napkin.
Here again is Bill Guerin.
I mean, it can get complicated because, you know, if a guy has a no-move, no-trade, he's got some power and he can kind of influence how things happen. But there's a lot. I mean, we've seen a bunch of them, you know, in the not so distant past that they can get complicated. And I think it's just really important that you communicate with the player, communicate with the agent, and just make sure that everybody's getting treated properly and you can make it happen as smoothly as possible. You have to just rip the Band-Aid off. But there are players that, you know, if you've had them for a long time, you get to know them. You get to know their families. You have relationships with them, and that can be tough. But listen, I was traded 4 times, and I'm still here to talk about it. My kids are okay. My wife's okay. Like, we're all doing okay. It's hard. It can be tough, but you're going to be okay. And I think for me, knowing that these players and their families will be okay in the long run, that makes it a little bit easier, too.
Thank you very much for listening to NHL Backstory. Please make sure to like and follow, and if you really enjoyed what you heard, why not tell a friend? Stay tuned for future episodes of the show. Until then, I'm Arto Ocal signing off. This episode of NHL Backstory is produced by NHL Productions in conjunction with Modulator Media and directed by Tal Pinchevsky. The coordinating producers are Bob Bender and Matt Nicholson. Additional production assistance provided by Karen Given, Farzad Kozad, and Ben Cook. Additional reporting by Derek Lee. Mixed by Tina Toby Mack. The executive producer of NHL Productions is Steve Mayer.